You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after a 2016 study was canceled because of a high number of adverse side effects, researchers appear to be on track to develop the first male birth control on the market. A science journalist shares the latest research. Now, UW-Madison's relationship with Indigenous cultures and students has made some progress over the last few decades with new programs like the Our Shared Future Initiative and other collaborations with Wisconsin tribes. One of the people at the center of many of these efforts is retiring at the end of the year and leaving behind a legacy of bringing Indigenous communities together on the Madison campus. Aaron Bird Bear first started working at UW in the year 2000 and became the school's first tribal relations director in 2019. He's retiring January 1st. I talked to him earlier today. Now, you were born, I understand, in New Hampshire. You're enrolled in the three affiliated tribes of the Fort Berthold Reservation, North Dakota. What originally brought you to Wisconsin and to UW-Madison?
There are three groups in the United States that tend to be highly itinerant: the military, the clergy, and academics. And one of my friends that I knew at the University of Washington, Seattle, became a faculty member in the Department of History here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And that faculty member remembered that I worked with Indigenous youth in STEM kind of pre-college programs at the University of Washington and recommended I apply and come to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And thankfully, I was hired back in the year 2000, and I came to UW-Madison to help strengthen the Native American student community in particular in partnership with a history faculty.
Now, when you looked at that community and what kind of things were available here at UW-Madison, what struck you about what was and wasn't available?
Well, there wasn't a strong kind of acknowledgement of the indigeneity of the space itself. There were Native American student groups that had been active since the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s. So there was a Indigenous student presence. And there was also the American Indian Studies program, which offered numerous courses and different types of academic programming, such as the storytelling festival, where they invite Indigenous speakers of their languages to share parts of their culture during the wintertime. And so, but beyond that, there wasn't a lot of real visible kind of Native American presence at the institution, which I found surprising because I'd just come from the University of Washington, Seattle a few years prior, which is one of the leading Research One universities in the United States for engaging Native nations and representing Native American cultures on the campus.
Now, you had this tribal relations director job that was recently created. In a lot of ways, you've been doing that job since you got here. Could you talk about some of the things that you helped establish to fix those absences you saw here?
So I kind of think about the incredible Native American campus community of faculty, staff, and students, and everybody had been chipping in some way to help fulfill the absence of a tribal relations director role or tribal liaison role at this institution. I think back to like the 2008 diversity forum, one of the first diversity forums held on campus, and they wanted the Ho-Chunk Nation to participate, particularly the president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. And they asked people like myself, then a student services coordinator, to arrange the president's participation at these major conferences. Also, you know, the university in designing Day-Job Residence Hall, I was then an assistant dean in the School of Education. They asked me to help facilitate parts of that process as well for kind of the interior design components of Day-Job Hall. So, you know, although we already have full-time jobs on campus, you know, various parts of campus would reach out to us, Indigenous faculty, staff, and student community members, and ask us to help with different kind of projects that intersected with Indigenous nations in some way.
One thing that's involved, I understand, is taking, at this point, hundreds or maybe even thousands of people on tours around campus. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, back in 2003, we created the First Nations Cultural Landscape Tour as a retention vehicle for Native American students at the institution. There's all used to be significant first-year retention challenges for American Indian students, and this tour was designed to highlight how special of a place this is. And so beginning in 2003, we started offering these types of tours. When I went to work in the School of Education in 2008, it became apparent that this tour was also very useful for our pre-service students, pre-service teachers in the teacher education program, to help them fulfill the Act 31 mandate to teach the history, culture, and tribal sovereignty of the Native Nations of Wisconsin at least twice in elementary and at least once in high school. And so we found this tour suddenly had utility beyond just helping Native American students orient themselves to campus. It offered a type of learning, a place-based experiential learning that people found valuable. And so over the years, yeah, we've offered many tours. In the height of pre-pandemic, my colleague Omar Poehler, who's the Indigenous Education Coordinator in the Office of the Provost here at UW-Madison, Omar Poehler and I offered 128 tours in the 2018-2019 academic year. And we don't offer tours when it's cold, so they're kind of crammed into the beginning of the semester.
And now, 2019, you became UW-Madison's first ever Tribal Relations Director. What has that role meant to you?
Well, it's an emerging role in higher education. We're not the first by any means to establish this type of position. University of Washington, Seattle, I mentioned, has had a position similar to this for a long period of time and started engaging in long-term relationships through memoranda of understanding with the tribal nations of the state of Washington back in the late 90s. So some universities have like a 20-year head start on us in thinking about long-term relationships with Native nations. There are approximately 30 tribal relations, tribal liaison staff across the United States today, with one of the preeminent staff being at the University of Arizona, Dr. Karen Francis Begay, and the role she's done from taking Native American Student Services and expanding it to these high-level consultancy or guidance positions for university leadership. And so her dissertation just came out this year on the tribal liaison, tribal relations role. And so it's nice to see the University of Wisconsin-Madison better fulfill the Wisconsin idea by liaising with governments in the way it liaises with other governments, say city, state, local governments. We've had a director of federal relations for a long time, a director of state relations, a director of community relations, a director of corporate relations that's now called the Office of Business Engagement. But for whatever reason, there was this kind of lack of understanding of to engage the 12 governments of the Native Nations of Wisconsin, we should have a similar position to fulfill the Wisconsin idea. And so I was really happy to see the university finally understand if it wants to fulfill the Wisconsin idea for all citizens within the state, it needed to have a director of tribal relations to liaise with the tribal governments of the state in the same ways that it liaises with city, state, and federal governments.
Now, as you leave this position and your long time at UW-Madison, if I may ask, what's next for you?
Retirement. That's the exciting part. You know, I've had a lot of pursuits over the years, and one that gave me a lot of spiritual nourishment was snowboarding. I was a skateboarder in the 70s in Colorado and a snowboarder in the 90s and 2000s, both in Colorado here in Wisconsin. And with my knees finally having had three knee surgeries from all my love of snowboarding, surfing is the next board sport that kind of is on my horizon. And I had the fortune of getting to surf in March in Hawaii this year. And it pops break, popular break off of Waikiki, a very kind break. And it's a little far out. It's about, you know, 400, 500-yard paddle off the shore. But when I got there, it was a bunch of 60- and 70-year-old men and a group of young women from Japan. So I knew I was in the bright, bright break, a kind break, a friendly break. And seeing those gentlemen out there, I was like, okay, I want to be you. You're the people I want to become in my retirement life. I just really look to pursuing surfing as much as I can.
Well, happy surfing to you, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, and just a reminder, surfing is an indigenous tradition given to us by the Kingdom of Hawaii and the indigenous inhabitants of that island. And so all these sports, you know, skateboarding, snowboarding, are all derived from the indigenous tradition of surfing. And surfing just keeps you connected to the world, living world around us, and allows us to really enjoy nature in ways that we might not otherwise. And so I'm thankful that these indigenous traditions keep nourishing my spirit as well.
Aaron Bird Bear is the Tribal Relations Director at UW-Madison for another few weeks. He retires at the end of this year. With us today, looking back on his two decades on campus, the progress he's seen over that time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a writer's own food tradition.
Food can conjure up vivid memories of childhood. The tastes and smells can send us to another place while creating new memories in the moment. That's why writer Nancy Jorgensen has been thinking a lot about her German heritage and being raised on raw foods.
My cousins and I spit the last of our watermelon seeds into Nana's lawn and tumbled into the house. I was 10 years old, or maybe 6 or 12. In the kitchen, Nana leaned against the counter. She stroked my cheek with one hand and held a plate in the other, slaughtered beef, freshly ground and bloody red. Our parents circled an oak table. My uncles clutched Gettleman or Old Milwaukee and blew cigarette smoke. On the stove, pickles boiled in vinegar. The smoke and steam made my breath catch. Mother got up from the table, and in a few seconds, a knife rested in her hand. In front of her, a loaf of rye. On the counter, a shaker of salt. "Would you like some raw beef and onions?" I put out my hand. I was raised on this traditional German food, along with kraut from Nana's stoneware crock and sausage from her hand-cranked meat grinder, oozed into animal intestine casings. We rarely ate in restaurants, our parents and grandparents creating meals from hand-tilled gardens, ancient grapevines, or a neighbor's Holstein. Now, my family often eats in restaurants. Last month, my husband Joel and I spent a week in Portland with our adult daughter, Gwen. One night in a local pub, she considered appetizers. On the menu, steak tartare. With a new name and extra ingredients, uncooked egg and capers, it was still Nana's raw beef and onions. We cook at home, too, and last week our older daughter Elizabeth prepared dinner for us. While we sipped Shiraz, she presented a tenderloin, crisp on the edges, but red and bleeding from the middle, just a few degrees past rare. Each bite, dipped in horseradish, stung my nose with a prickly ache. It took me back to Nana's garden, where that gnarly root grew among her beets and kohlrabi and turnips. I savored the burn. As Nana peeled carrots or cooked a warm potato salad dressing, she told me I was German and Pennsylvania Dutch. Her pride, like her red-checked tablecloth, underpinned every meal. It was clear my daughters inherited her German pedigree and taste for hearty dishes. A while back, Gwen, Elizabeth, Joel, and I spent 5 minutes spitting into tubes. When the results came back, Nana's genetics weren't as strong as I believed. My German DNA is less than 33%. I'm also 11% Scandinavian and 13% British. And Nana never mentioned over pork chops that I'm 8% Ashkenazi Jewish. I wonder what those ancestors would say about our habits with uncooked meat and milk from the neighbor's cow. Before the holidays this year, we planned our Christmas menu. Gwen chose pickled herring, popular with German fishermen. Elizabeth requested pretzels, a German baking tradition. And I made German apple pie. But then I whipped a pint of cream, a British birthright, and dropped meatballs in gravy, definitely Danish. We included a Mediterranean salad, Asian egg rolls, and southern pecan pie. Surveying the dishes, I realized our German heritage a muted presence. But our Wisconsin ties shouted. Piper porch wine, raised grain beer, Wisconsin-produced milk. From our own garden, pickled cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, Duchess apples. A bounty of food and tradition, as wide as the world and as narrow as Wisconsin.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer based in Waukesha. And her story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a science journalist brings us up to date on the latest research on male birth control. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when you hear the phrase male birth control, you might remember some years back, 2016 it was, a study that was canceled at the time some in the media declared that men can't handle side effects that women face daily. That didn't get it quite right. The study was cut short because a lot of men showed significant adverse side effects. Since that 2016 study, though, and before it, researchers have been working to try to develop a male contraceptive. Now they may be closer than ever with a promising new candidate in development. Eleanor Cummins is a science journalist and adjunct assistant professor at New York University's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. She wrote a recent piece for STAT about the quest for male contraception. Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as you write, that 2016 announcement that a study had been cut short, the way it was reported on the media, I don't know, it seemed like to close the door on male contraception, the idea that, hey, men won't want to deal with side effects, so why bother? Talk about how that didn't get it quite right.
Yeah, absolutely. So the World Health Organization had undertaken a study for a male hormonal contraceptive with a very long name. But the basic premise is the same as 50 years of research in this field, which is how can we sort of manipulate the sort of male, hormonal and endocrine system in order to disrupt sperm production and therefore prevent pregnancy. The World Health Organization went through a trial to look at one possible way of doing this. And what they found was that it was pretty effective. On the whole, the participants in the trial really liked it. But some of them were having really serious emotional side effects, up to and including an individual who attempted suicide. And they decided, we we need to sort of beg off here, right? Maybe these side effects are too serious. We don't exactly understand what's happening. And ultimately, we don't think it's worth it to continue this trial. So that gets picked up. It's, you know, this whole narrative of men are wimps. They can't handle contraceptives, you know, which women have been dealing with similar side effects, you know, for decades. And it really felt like a nail in the coffin, according to a lot of male contraceptive researchers I spoke to. But fortunately, things are looking brighter once again.
Yeah, one of the most promising ones researchers are finding is, I think it's a long name drug. It's being called NES/T. What is it?
Yes, Neste. Neste is a combination of testosterone, which we all know, and another hormone called nesterone. This is a drug that is actually administered, at least in its current form, as a sort of liquid gel. So you take a pre-metered pump, almost as if you were, you know, putting a little bit of hand sanitizer into your hand, and you apply it every day to your back. And so they're having a lot of success with this. While the phase two clinical trial is still underway. And so that data hasn't been, you know, reported yet. Researchers are saying that they're finding that this does seem to be extremely effective in preventing pregnancy. It seems to be safe and it seems to be reversible, which we know because when couples have discontinued this trial, you know, they've gone through a whole year on Neste alone as their sole birth control method. They've been able to come out the other side and have children. So things are looking pretty optimistic that maybe we have landed on a reversible hormonal male contraceptive. But there's a long way to go.
Yeah. One weird wild card you write about is, as you mentioned, testosterone is kind of the main thing people are using. It weirdly stops sperm production, apparently, except it does it really unpredictably, where one population might respond really well to it, another one, not so much.
Yes. So researchers have been, to my surprise, researching male contraceptives for almost as long as they've been researching female contraceptives. We have, you know, research trials going back to the 1970s, so more than 50 years of sort of evidence looking at this. And when we started to focus on testosterone, we found it was, you know, really effective. From a contraceptive standpoint, because when you add more, as you said, to the male system, the brain responds by sort of breaking that link with the testes where testosterone is produced. And the result is that sort of testosterone levels, you know, within the body plummet, as does sperm production. So this is like a really powerful tool, right? And researchers started to begin to figure out how to manipulate that. But what they found was that it's not evenly sort of effective across populations. In one study, they found that while almost all Asian males responded in a given trial to this testosterone strategy, a lot of their Caucasian counterparts actually failed to reach the ideal sperm suppression stage. And that's when sperm levels drop low enough that we can say, more or less, at least while you're taking this drug, you are infertile. And so that has left us in this sort of weird circumstance where, you know, 100% of females who take female birth control are going to respond. What does it mean if only 97, 98% of males respond to contraceptives? We've never really faced a situation quite like that before.
Another interesting question you write about is, you know, when you're evaluating any medication, you're saying, okay, here are the side effects and risks. Do the benefits outweigh those risks? With a woman taking birth control, the risk you're looking at is unwanted pregnancy. Easy. For a guy, how do they factor that risk in to balance it versus side effects?
Right. So I would say right now that no one really knows. We don't have like a well-developed sort of ethical, you know, construct to evaluate these pros and cons of a drug in someone who isn't going to be physically affected, at least by an unintended pregnancy or by a complicated pregnancy. So researchers are trying to fill that gap. Right now, we're seeing a lot of efforts to develop a model of what is being called shared risk. And so the idea is that, yes, maybe we haven't, you know, been able to sort of summarize, like, okay, here is what the male partner sort of risks with an unintended pregnancy. But that doesn't mean that there aren't side effects, right? Whether those are social, economic, or perhaps biological, more research is needed. And similarly, maybe like that doesn't matter, right? If two people decide to, you know, take on, you know, both the sort of pros and cons of sex, then that means that they also, you know, share that responsibility for the optimal outcome. So with a shared risk model, researchers are trying to sort of pave the way for saying, yes, maybe, you know, there are an increase in side effects from male contraceptives for men and no sort of risk of unintended pregnancy. But that's not good enough anymore, right? And we need sort of a model that looks at both partners as a unit.
We've talked a little bit about biology and ethics. Now, how about the economics? Is there a sense that, okay, we have a successful form of male birth control, people are going to buy it?
Right. So I think that there is a lot of optimism now that there is a sort of a consumer base for this, that there's definitely people who are ready and willing to take on this responsibility for male contraceptives. You know, in trials to date, the people we're seeing who are enrolling and saying, like, yes, I'll be a guinea pig, test this on me, are often men whose female partners have sort of hit the end of the road in terms of what the available contraceptives are to them. So they've had bad reactions to, you know, everything from copper IUDs to hormonal pills. So they're saying, yeah, I want to take that on. It looks like, you know, we would have ultimately like more than half of men of sort of reproductive age in the U.S. ultimately sort of open to an idea of a hormonal contraceptive, which is great. But what we're seeing is that the investment, which typically would come from the pharmaceutical industry, isn't there yet. And that's going to be crucial for pushing this forward, both, you know, in collecting the research needed and actually taking it all the way to the Food and Drug Administration, to the FDA, and saying, you know, will you approve this for use?
Very briefly, in our just last quarter minute, is there a timeline when we might see something like this on the market?
I think that we're not going to see this for another decade, which is, you know, a little bit shocking because researchers have already been cranking on this for 15 years. But yeah, I would say that another decade seems like the sort of consensus right now, just in terms of what work is left to be done.
Eleanor, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eleanor Cummins is a science journalist. She wrote about male birth control research in the journal Stat. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's more than just punching supervillains. Superhero stories can have a political message. We'll hear more from the creators of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Universe. Plus, we'll get the latest on affordable housing issues around the state and evictions here in Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, you may have seen the headlines, a breakthrough in nuclear fusion, but it's still a long road to fusion power in our daily lives. A Wisconsin physicist explains the latest news and the basics. First, how would you describe your relationship with food? Healthy, unhealthy, good, bad, friend, or enemy? All of the above? A lot of us have complicated relationships with the food we eat and with our body image. In her new book, our next guest shares the story of her own relationship with food, and some of her experiences may sound familiar to you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story of your own to share, are you in a good place now with the food you eat? Do you eat specific things when you feel certain emotions or to stop feeling certain emotions? Have you gone through transformations, back and forths in your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rabia Chaudhry is an attorney, advocate, podcast host, and author of the book Adnan's Story, The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial. Her new book is called Fatty, Fatty, Boom, Boom, a memoir of food, fat, and family. Rabia, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, your memoir is like a memoir. It's deeply personal. And like a good memoir, I think a lot of people will read it. And even if their experiences aren't exactly the same, they may not along with some of your experiences. Why did you want to share this deeply personal story of your relationship with food and body image?
Well, you know, I mean, look, any person can write a number of given memoirs based on their life. It just depends on what you want to focus on. But I thought about the fact that a lot of my work has been public facing, doing all kinds of advocacy on a variety of issues. And when I pick up the memoir or bio of a public figure, you know, I don't want to read like everything I already know about their career. So I wanted to tell a story that I hadn't told before. And I thought one that had much more broader resonance. I know this is an issue that a lot of people deal with constantly. I mean, like, you know, we all have to eat. We all have bodies, obviously. And there's just so many emotions and sentiments and just all kinds of, you know, challenges related to these issues for us. So I thought this was a story that I'd rather focus on because all the other stuff I've talked about at length and written about as well.
Your story starts before you're born, your relationship with food. Can you talk about the food culture you came from in Pakistan and how it shaped your arrival here in the U.S. and your encounter with American food?
Yeah, I was born in Pakistan, and you know the book does start with my parents getting married. I'm the firstborn, and when my paternal grandfather found out my mother was expecting, he was very excited, and he bought a buffalo to tie up in the yard so my mom could get fresh milk day and night to nurture the child and nourish the mother, and you know so the food culture back home is especially you know in the 70s and stuff, and things have changed a little bit now, but most of it is, you know, fresh. It's whatever's available daily, whatever's seasonal, whatever's local. You just go to your market next door and see what came in that morning, and that's what you decide how to cook that day. And then when my parents came to the US and I came here as an infant, it was a whole different world where you could get anything you wanted at any time of the season from anywhere in the world, and everything was packaged and processed and available constantly, and the abundance was overwhelming. The problem was my parents equated that abundance with, and all these options with, like, good choices, that these are all great choices, maybe even better than what we had back home, not knowing that that was probably wrong.
And an alien thing about U.S. culture to your family was the idea of snacking. That was a big switch.
Yeah, snacking is not, I mean, again, things might have changed, but certainly when my parents were growing up, snacking was not part of the culture. In Pakistan, you ate your three meals a day and maybe had chai, one tea break in the late afternoon, and that was it. But the idea of constantly having something to munch on as you're going about your day, you know, working or whatever, it was completely new. And then, you know, in America, I mean, having entire aisles full of snack items, it was kind of shocking.
As you mentioned, you came to the U.S. as an infant. You write about a summer trip to Pakistan. Your family had all put on weight, you write. Could you talk about the response you got from relatives back in Pakistan?
Yeah, the first time we returned after we had immigrated, I was about 2 years old, and my parents and I in those 2 years had put on a lot of that abundance, and it was very visible. And my grandfather, that same grandfather who got the buffalo for my mother, saw us and was really deeply concerned. He's like, "What?" And he picked me up and he put me back down because I weighed a lot. I was pretty big, and he said, "What have you done to her?" And he just couldn't understand. And also, you know, our relatives were like, "What have you guys done to yourselves?" And I think my parents, you know, they were kind of newlyweds, like kids in a candy store. They kind of didn't even see what was happening to them, with all the friend with all the burgers and fried chicken and everything else they were consuming in America. So, yeah, it was. I think they very quickly realized that, oh, we need to try to make some changes. But it seemed like they weren't able to turn the clock back.
Now, for you, it seems like there's a slow burn here. There's maybe not one moment, but looking back, when do you think you started to say, hey, people are looking at me differently because of weight? When did you, I guess, first evolve this concept of body image and the idea that people might be seeing yours and you seeing your own in a negative way?
You know, I think very early on, I realized there was a difference between me and other kids when I would get together, like, you know, we'd have family functions and stuff, and the other kids would be so busy playing, they weren't interested in what was on the table and the meal getting, and I was at the front of the line. You know, I was always more focused on when is the food going to come out, and then getting my plate before everybody else, and then quietly eating undisturbed. There was always that, but the idea that it was like an actual problem probably came around the time I was 10 or 11, and when we went back to Pakistan again, by that time I understood what was being said around me, and I came back and I took up jogging for the first time, you know, but truly, you know, a lot of it, you know, whether it was my parents or cousins or uncles and aunts and stuff, none of it felt malicious or hurtful, so I kind of let it. I didn't take it real seriously until I probably hit college.
We're talking to Rabia Chowdhury. You may know her from her book, Adnan's Story, and the Serial podcast. She's got a new book out. It's called Fatty, Fatty, Boom, Boom, A Memoir of Food, Fat, and Family, looking at her connection to food, our connection to food, body image, and some of the negative extremes we could swing back and forth to and from. You can join in if you have an experience to share of your own, if you're willing to talk about that. Fine if you're not. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stepping out of the narrative here a bit, you talk about in your conclusion, swinging over your life between food deprivation and food depravity, quoting here, miserable on both ends of that pendulum. You don't write that you're in a magical perfect place by the end of the book, but how did you get out of that pendulum?
It took many decades. About 4 years ago, when I was in my mid-40s, I finally stumbled upon something that I had never done. And I had tried everything. There's nothing I hadn't tried. And also all kinds of exercises, like running miles and miles a day, walking steps, jumping rope, everything. I had never done strength training before. And I began strength training, having absolutely no faith in it. And I couldn't believe in months, like my body completely transformed. I couldn't believe that my body could do the things it was doing. I had never felt stronger or better. But also, suddenly, because I was feeling stronger and I wanted to keep performing better and better, I just, like, my food choices started aligning with that. I was like, wait, where can I get the most protein? What can I eat that's going to make me like a beast in the gym tonight? You know, it just, and I think what happened at that time was I just realized how much bad information I had been working on all these years, you know, about how I was counting calories when it was never about that, how I was slogging away doing aerobics when it was never about that. And that was really what changed my entire relationship with food and my body.
One of the most disturbing moments to me reading the book, you're writing about your first husband, happily now your ex-husband, who's abusive, yeah, physically and clearly verbally. And he used your weight as a control technique, quoting him as you quote him in the book. Where will you go? Who will take you? You couldn't even support yourself hooking because no man would pay 10 bucks for you. Using your body image, your own, yeah, worries. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, like, that was, you know, I got married very young. My first marriage, I was 21 years old. And I really did enter that marriage thinking nobody will marry me. This is their... I got to take up this guy or I will never find anyone again, because I had just been conditioned to believe nobody would want me. And he was right off the bat, very verbally and physically abusive. And that's when the self-loathing started. Him and his entire family, I lived with them, and they never let me forget that I was too fat. I was too dark as far as they were concerned. They're from South Asia, but they were very light-skinned. And I never started really hating myself until that marriage, because none of the things my family said felt malicious, but now it was all very malicious. So yeah, I mean, those things stick with you. And that was a shocking moment to me that that's how he viewed me. And I'm thankful I only gave that relationship 5 years of my life and not more.
We're talking to attorney, advocate, and author Rabia Chowdhury about her new book. It's called Fatty, Fatty, Boom, Boom, A Memoir of Food, Fat, and Family. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Not always easy to talk about our difficult relationships with food and body image. If you're willing to, I would love to hear from you. Again, 800-642-1234. Was there something growing up that set you on a path that you regret in hindsight, in the way you eat and the way you think of yourself? Have you arrived at a happier place, as our guest has? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Rabia Chowdhury. She's an attorney, advocate, podcast host, author of the book Adnan's Story. We're talking about her latest book. It's called Fatty, Fatty, Boom, Boom, A Memoir of Food, Fat, and Family. She writes about her often difficult relationship with food and body image, how she's arrived ultimately at a better place. If you have a story to share, and you're willing to share it, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rabia, I think a lot of people might not be willing to talk about this. There's a certain sense of shame, maybe stigma, that comes along with weight, with being seen as overweight or obese. That's no secret. Is that important to you to help get people talking about these things?
Yeah, certainly. This is not something I even could have spoken about publicly or written about years ago, and I never have before. And it took me maybe an entire 8 months to a year to convince myself that this was the story I wanted to tell. I knew exactly what I'd be exposing myself to, and I'd be talking about things that people even very close to me in my life didn't know, like the fact that I got weight loss surgery in 2015, because there's so much stigma and shame around it. But, you know, there is something magical that happens after a certain age where you're like, what do I care what people think? Because no matter what, people will judge you. And at the end of the day, if I'm able to be authentic and tell the story, then I know that it's going to mean so much to so many people. And that's what I keep hearing over and over again, all throughout the book tours. I'm meeting people. They're like, we have nothing in common, but this is my story. Like, you have told my story. And it feels so good to hear people's responses, and how one woman wrote to me and said, after reading your book, I have finally released the shame of weighing 100 pounds when I was in fourth grade. I mean, you know, years, decades later, it's incredible.
You were, as you mentioned, in the public eye with your advocacy for Adnan Syed, and you were in, you know, People magazine and on camera and things like that. I would want to do that no matter what I looked like. How was that for you to be stepping into, you know, the makeup room and getting ready for photo shoots and being on camera?
I mean, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. And, you know, it was, I have spent my life always avoiding the camera, right? Like my friends, my sister, my cousin, they would always be mugging for the camera on holidays and this and that. But, and I always be like, I'll take the picture. I don't want to be in the picture. This has been most of my life. And so after Serial, there was just no avoiding it. And I had to make I literally had to make a very conscious choice and talk myself down from my anxiety, because I said, either I can literally let the momentum in this case die away because I don't want to be on camera, or I have to just forget about what I look like and how I feel, and all the pictures I'll get tagged in which I'm going to feel terrible about, because I have to think about Adnan. And it seemed like such a petty, petty comparison, right? Like, so I just, I didn't enjoy any of it. It was all torture for me.
Now, and I promoed this conversation earlier today, talking about how you learned to love your body and reading the book more closely. I didn't quite get that right. I realized you talk about the value of learning to not hate your body. Talk about getting to that place.
Yeah. Look, listen, I'm sure there are people out there who love their bodies. I don't really know anybody like that. And there's almost nobody in my life who really loves their body. But I think I'm just happy being at the point where I don't hate it anymore, which is how I felt about it for a very, very long time. I just felt trapped inside like my own enemy. And so just, it's such a relief to be at peace with my body and to understand how well she's served me given everything I've put her through. So, you know, I, for folks who love their bodies, I mean, that's nirvana to me. I hope to get there one day, and it's okay if I don't though. I'm happy just like, you know, just us being like, you know, calling a truce.
Now you're a parent yourself. How have you approached food and body image with your own kids after your own experience?
You know, I've done my best to isolate my kids from like all of my own, you know, issues around it, not talking in front of them about, you know, how I'm feeling about certain things. And I've tried my best. I can't say I've done that perfectly, but what I have realized over the course of parenting, and I have children in complete different generations. I have a 25-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And what I've realized is that my 25-year-old to this day eats the way I used to eat when I was raising her in her early years, in my early 20s. And my 14-year-old eats like I was eating in my 30s when I had discovered salads and I was doing a little bit better job. Like, so what I realized is my kids' palates, and they're getting bigger clues from watching what I'm doing versus me saying anything. They're modeling their behavior. They eat like I eat, especially in the formative years. And, you know, I began like being much more regular about getting physical activity, going to the gym or just doing stuff. That's what my 14-year-old is like, because that's what she's seen in most of her formative years is mama going to the gym. And so now a few years ago, she started going with me and she lifts weights and it's great.
Talking to Rabia Chowdhury, her new book is called Fatty, Fatty, Boom, Boom, a memoir of food, fat and family. Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us?
Well, I've struggled with being overweight my whole life. I've had weight loss surgery. It was somewhat successful, but I think from the time I was a young child, I was really in a battle of wills with my mother, who was always trying to get me to lose weight, even when I was 7 or 8 or 9. And I can recall going to Woolworths and quick wolfing down a hot fudge sundae before I went home so that I could calm myself down, I guess, or nurture myself with ice cream.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for sharing that story, Rabia.
Oh, yeah, that like resonates so deeply. I mean, we end up getting these dysfunctional relationships with food because of the messages that we're given. And when you deprive children of food or you control it, not only are you like, first of all, you're not going to succeed. What those parents are trying to do, and you know, a lot of times this is part of like how generational trauma works. I mean, it could be that her mother experienced something similar and was kind of transferring and projecting her own body images and struggles onto this child, hoping to isolate them from experiencing the same thing when they got older, but actually reinforcing it. But, you know, one of the most tragic things about this people who experience this their whole lives is that we feel starved for food. You never feel full, but you also don't feel satisfied. So even when you do the thing like the stuffing yourself in the middle of the night when nobody's watching, which I did for many years, it didn't satisfy me. I didn't feel happy. I didn't enjoy even the food. It just increased like my disappointment in myself, my self-loathing. And at the end of the day, I didn't even get to enjoy it. I mean, just being at a place where I'm like, I'm actually allowed to enjoy food is such a rejection of what most, like, you know, like a lot of social cues that if you are a certain size, you're not even allowed to enjoy food. And it's so unfair.
Thanks for that call, Kay. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. First, I'd like to say to your guest, I'm sorry that you had to go through that. I went through something similar with body image, but not quite exactly the same. When I was probably about 7 or 8, my mother put us, my brother, my sister, and I into swimming lessons at Elm Grove Pool. And I have a birthmark on my chest that's not very large, but kids would tease me and say, you know, like, oh, you got a third nipple, whatever. My kids can be cruel, you know. And up to this day, I just turned 43 recently. And still, when I go to the beach or a pool, I won't take my shirt off until I jump in, which is crazy because it's like I'm an adult now. But these have long-lasting, lingering impacts that just change the way we are as people, and it's unfortunate.
Interesting. Rabia, that the things that we make get made fun of, mocked as a kid can stick with us, as Marcus says, through our adult lives. Oop, I think we have lost our connection with Rabia Chowdhury. Or she is not hearing us. Talking to Rabia Chowdhury, you may know her from the Adnan Syed story and the Serial podcast. She has a podcast of her own and the book called Adnan's Story. Been talking about her new book. It's called Fatty Fatty Boom Boom, a memoir of food, fat, and family. We have lost that connection with her. If you have a story of your own that you might share that maybe might inspire someone, you can let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And we can maybe share that on a future show. Do we? Yes, I think we have Rabia. Rabia, we have you back now.
And I'm back.
Sorry we lost you there. I wanted to ask in our last minute, though, and follow up on what you were saying about being able to enjoy food. That's one of the things that made me happiest about reading your book, is that you are in a place where you enjoy food. You share some of your favorite recipes at the end of it. For someone going through who's maybe earlier in this journey than you were, what encouragement can you offer them to end up in that place?
Look, I mean, like, it's not a straight line. I think therapy helped a lot. I mean, getting therapy got me, you know, through a lot of this. And I just want people to understand that everybody deserves to enjoy good food, deserves to treat themselves well with it, not be judged for loving it and not judging themselves for it, but also that we also deserve not to hurt ourselves with it. You know what I mean? So if it's not bringing you pleasure, then that's something that has to be deeply examined, because it just means that somehow you were, you know, you were taught that you're not allowed to enjoy this and you're not allowed to have a good relationship with food.
Rabia, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Rabia Chowdhury, attorney, advocate, podcast host, and author. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Fatty Fatty Boom Boom, a memoir of food, fat, and family. Coming up after the news, a breakthrough in nuclear fusion shows that we might be able to replicate that natural energy source. A Wisconsin expert on fusion joins us to talk about the new discovery. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.